Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday. This is the day when you and I have an opportunity to meet an expert and learn lots of things that will help us to broaden our perspectives about the world in which we live. Today's guest, I am very pleased to introduce to you, is Dr. Robert M. Brown III, and he is a medical sociologist, and he is also the author of Economic Stress, Harsh Truths, and Keys to Empowerment. Dr. Brown, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you, Dr. Brewer. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Now, Dr. Brown, I don't hear a lot about medical sociologists. Let's take a step away from your book for a moment and give us sort of a thumbnail sketch of what life was like for you growing up and how you came to choose medical sociology and why the economy is just personally an important issue for you.
Well, I'm a native Washingtonian, and I grew up specifically in Southeast Washington and lived there for the first 11 and a half years of my life, and then my parents moved the family out to Northern Virginia. But I've been here in the District of Columbia, in the region actually, all my life. And my first job was actually at the World Bank, sometimes known as the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development. And it was there that I got exposed to people from just about every corner of the globe, different languages, different cultures, different ways of being. And that fostered my interest in wanting to learn more about groups. And so as a sociology major, I was seeking greater understanding about the scientific study of society, which is, in fact, what sociology is. But as I moved on to grad school, my interest became a bit more targeted, and I became particularly interested in issues of health, healing, and illness. But as a sociologist, I wanted to understand some of the social determinants of health, healing, and illness. Thus, when I went on to pursue a PhD, I concentrated in what is called medical sociology. And so as a medical sociologist, I'm not just concerned about issues and health, healing, and illness, but I'm also concerned about how social determinants, like economic stress, for example, can affect the state of one's mental, emotional, spiritual, physical, and economic well-being. And the last part of that is how I define health. It's really a holistic phenomenon. And so coming forward several years later, I really started to look at the impact of economic stress, again, a social determinant of health, on the state of one's well-being. And that's really the kind of the quick genesis of how this came about.
Well, let me ask you this. As a native Washingtonian, having lived here in the Washington, D.C. area your entire life, what is your sense of the current state of economic stress just in the Washington, D.C. area versus what you grew up with? Is it the same? Is it more? Is it less?
Well, I think we have to look at things like demographic transition. Clearly, there has been a process where people who may have lived or been a part of families that were in the District of Columbia proper for maybe multiple generations have been largely displaced. And so you have seen sort of this resurgence of affluence in areas in the District of Columbia where there has been abject poverty. And I'm speaking specifically about areas in Northwest Washington, that are not necessarily west of the park, but then obviously two areas in Ward 7 and 8. And so what I have seen is a city that, in my humble opinion, has become far more segregated than it has been over the last 30 or so years, because if you go to downtown, and I was just in downtown last week, and it was a jaw-dropping experience when you walk down 9th Street and 8th Street and some of the letter streets, and you see these high-end stores that are in places now a couple of years ago that were vacant. And so when you've got these high-end stores and you see all of the building that is going on in the city, the level of construction, which has simply been unprecedented in my lifetime as a native Washingtonian, it does cause you to ask, well, what is becoming of the people who are on the margins of society economically? And my best estimate in response to that is that they are largely being left behind. And so when you talk about levels of economic stress, that tends to be disproportionately experienced by those who are in the poor wards of the city. And it should also be noted that the District of Columbia, based on data from the Economic Policy Institute, has the highest percentage of college graduates in the entire nation. And so we are really in the midst of a resurgence of affluence in the nation's capital, which is a good thing, but my concern is that affluence evenly distributed among all of the residents of the nation's capital?
My humble opinion is no.
Well, it's a rhetorical question. Yeah, it's a rhetorical question.
You're kidding.
And you can clearly see it. And
yeah.
In fact, you know, in places that I would have been concerned about walking in the daytime, maybe 20 or so years ago, you are seeing a very diverse group of people who are in those spaces. And, you know, as I say, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, a good indicator that neighborhoods are changing is when you stop seeing the pit bulls and you start seeing more shih tzus and poodles.
And you start seeing apartments for sale that are starting at low 500s.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the specifics of the book that you have authored. As you're talking about the change in housing and the change in shopping experiences, and we're looking at economic stress, and we're looking at a whole group of people that in theory have certainly been and are in the process of continuing to be displaced, the economic stress is heightened even more so for those individuals. And, you know, I look at a survey that was done apparently by the APA back in 2008. And in that survey, it said that the economy was a significant source of stress, up from 66% in April, and this was done in October, that the top stressors for Americans were money, that was 81%, and the economy was 80%. And they go further on down the line. If that was the case back in 2008, and this is for the broad society, what must it be now for a particular part of society who has, you know, spent their lives in, for example, the District of Columbia, and now, quite frankly, I'm not sure where they live, where they can live, where they can afford to live?
Well, I think that's a great question for the district government and the mayor. But I will say that for poor people, for those who have been systematically disenfranchised, and that may have been the result of intergenerational poverty, it's going to become not impossible to live in the nation's capital. And so when you look at the data from 2008 to now, things have actually gotten worse for people who are on the margins or who are living in poverty. And I say that because the cost of living in the nation's capital skyrocketed. You mentioned the housing costs. Well, the question then is, well, where is affordable housing? Not just affordable housing, Dr. Brewer, but affordable housing that is safe and livable. We have to have that conversation. What is the quality of access to the resources and pathways that would allow people to get the education and training to secure the jobs of the 21st century that pay living wages? That's another question that we have to ask, and these are policy questions. But when you look at the fragmentation of families that can be the result of economic stress, and we talk about the inability of a person or family to meet their financial obligations because of job loss, not enough work, job instability or low wages, and the impact this can have on their mental, emotional, spiritual, physical, and economic well-being, when I think of the poorest people in the nation's capital, they are getting hammered across every major economic category that there is. And so the question then becomes, as we begin to look at the growing levels of affluence, we also have to equally examine how can we empower those who are on the margins of society in the nation's capital, because clearly the messaging seems to be we only want to attract, that is the District of Columbia, a certain socioeconomic demographic. And so with that, you also have to look at the racial makeup, because now we're talking about disproportionate numbers of people who, frankly, are not black or brown. And these are conversations that we have to have. But from an economic stress vantage point, when you're looking at those who may be working poor, that is living paycheck to paycheck, versus those who are what we call experiencing absolute poverty, which is a life-threatening deprivation of water, food, clothing, shelter in the nation's capital right now, those are two very different categories of people. And so the needs of those two groups are very, very distinct and very, very different. And it's really important to be able to parse out effectively and accurately the differences that exist.
So when we talk about economic stress, when you wrote this book, Economic Stress, what population were you talking about? Were you wanting it to be for everyone or for a particular group?
No, absolutely not. And thank you for asking that question. No, this book is intended for people who may be working class, who may be middle class, but have found themselves in situations where they are experiencing economic stress based on the definition I just offered. This book was strategically not intended for people who are poor because, again, they are facing a set of realities that would not be covered in a book of this type. We're talking about how do I live from the morning to the afternoon to the night? How do I negotiate the community services agency to get food stamps, to get WIC? How do I fill out an application to get Medicaid? These are issues that the typical person who is working poor or maybe middle class or lower middle class does not have to face. How do I adjust to the idea of not having a place to live because I have been evicted? I now have to go to a homeless shelter, but I don't want to go to the homeless shelter because chances are I may be robbed. How do I negotiate taking my young baby and toddler to a homeless shelter when they may be at risk for being victimized? Those are the types of issues, and I'm just scratching the surface, that a person who is in poverty might have to address versus what the person who is working poor or maybe middle class but who finds him or herself in an economically stressful situation may have to address. So the book is specifically intended for the latter population.
And, you know, what's interesting is how we identify words and what they mean to us, because clearly what you're saying is that economic stress for someone who is living in absolute poverty could be, as you described, do I, you know, live under the bridge or do I go to a shelter? Whereas for at the other end of the spectrum, economic stress is, gee, I really want this place for $1.5 million, but I've only got $1 million. So it is fascinating how we think about economic stress just across the populations. Another thing that heavily impacted, as I understand your writing of this book, was as you were looking at the relationship between economic stress and health, particularly when the federal government shut down during October of 2013, which nobody ever thought would really happen, but clearly we were wrong.
Well, we were wrong, unfortunately, and what's even worse and unconscionable is that government shutdown back in 2013, October, was avoidable. And so one of the points and arguments that I make in that section of the book is that for persons who were salaried employees, chances are they got reimbursed for the period of time that the government was actually closed. But for low-wage workers, we talk about janitors, we talk about food service workers, we talk about maintenance workers, they tend not to have any leave, any sick leave, and so those days that were missed were days for which they would not be reimbursed. And therein lies part of the dynamic between those who may be working poor, living paycheck to paycheck, but still able to manage, those who may be middle class or better, versus those who are low-wage workers who don't have not just the benefits that go along with many salary types of positions. But what they also lack, Dr. Brewer, is the advocacy coming forth from persons in positions of power to say, we cannot allow workers who may be at the lowest end of the scale not to have some of the basic types of benefits that we come to expect and often take for granted.
You know, in some ways, it kind of feels like it has an air of the potential for being mass murder. And we don't really think about it that way. And for many of us, that's kind of okay.
Well, it's not okay. But what we have seen over the last several years is that because of the economic stress across social class, there have been spikes in levels of violence, whether it's in the home, whether it's in communities. And we unfortunately are seeing more and more instances of it. Part of the narrative that is often not articulated as it relates to poor people and economic stress is their incredible capacity to endure.
Yes.
And to also navigate systems that really keep them in spaces of disempowerment. And an example of that would be the person who may be poor, who has to work two or three jobs just to make ends meet. They're getting no benefits, they have no type of leave, they have no type of health insurance. And part of the frustration is that many people who are working these types of low-wage jobs do not have the capacity to find other work because what? They have no time that they can take off to look for other positions. And so they may be living to work. And so by the time they get home, after maybe a 15 or 16-hour day, they're exhausted, only to get a few hours of sleep, and then they have to do it all over again. And this is why I say we've got to have this conversation as it relates to relieving economic stress, particularly among poorer people from a policy level.
And certainly if you're working the 16, 18, 20-hour days, your physical health as well as your emotional health is significantly impaired just by the fact of not being able to get decent sleep, let alone the stress that is wrapped up in needing to have so many jobs to get from day to day.
But how do you know this? Because chances are you have no health insurance coverage. And so unfortunately, what ends up happening in too many instances is that people who are poor use emergency rooms as the primary care health vehicle. And so, again, there are a series of issues. And again, I talked at the top of the show about the social determinants of health. And so if you have no health insurance, you're just hoping that you're going to be okay. And chances are you don't go to see a doctor in the emergency room until something is seriously wrong. But we also know that chances are that the health challenge may have been one which could have been in play for some time. And now as a health care provider, you're in a situation rather than providing primary health care, which is where you stop something before it starts, you may be forced to administer health care that is either of the second variety, secondary health care or tertiary health care. And tertiary health care is the worst case scenario where you're trying to manage the level of pain and increase as much as you can that patient's comfort because the health challenge has escalated to a point where it can no longer be managed. And so that's where we're finding a lot of poor people in cities across the country, not just the nation's capital, because they do not have proper health care access.
We are going to take a break in a moment, Dr. Brown, but when we come back, I recall during the elections one of the then candidates suggesting that health care was not a right. It was a privilege. We'll come back with that as we return. Folks, this is Dr. Pamela Brewer. You are listening to Mind Talk, and I am having a conversation with Dr. Robert M. Brown III. Dr. Brown is a medical sociologist and is the author of Economic Stress, Harsh Truths, and Keys to Empowerment. We'll be right back. Dr. Brown, earlier you spoke of the social determinants of health, and certainly we've been talking about the impact of economic stress and sustained economic stress on the physical and emotional health of individuals. And yet, relatively recently, we had someone who was then running for the presidential presidency, a comment that healthcare was not a right. What's your thought about that?
Well, the fact is, access to the best healthcare in this country is based solely on one thing, and that's your capacity to pay. And one of the things that I expressed often is that wealthy people in this country don't pay health insurance premiums every month. They self-insure. And so the average person, however, is paying a health insurance premium. And so clearly, when you talk about health care access being a privilege rather than a right, the person who made that comment is espousing what we call a market maximized philosophy, which means that through the privatization of health care coverage, one can then determine and set fees for which medical services would be dispensed. And so, obviously, the flip side of that argument being made by at least one candidate is that there should be universal health coverage. Now, our neighbors to the north, Canada, that is, offers universal health coverage for all of its citizens. And so the reasons that the United States of America could not adopt at least a similar type of healthcare system is related directly to dollars and cents.
Doesn't bode that well for so many of us. Give us an example of some of the specific kinds of health issues that one might experience when going through sustained economic stress.
Well, it really depends on the person. It depends on their capacity to manage the economic stress through proactive measures. It also depends on whether they may have pre-existing conditions. Perhaps it might be hypertension, it could be high cholesterol, it might be diabetes. So economic stress can create, in some instances, a health challenge, and in other instances, it might actually exacerbate an existing health challenge. So it really depends on the individual, the family from which they come, any history of illnesses or diseases that may be present in that person's family, but most importantly, their capacity to not just manage the stress in their life, but also have access to good health care. And as I said a moment ago, the best way to address a health challenge is to be as proactive as possible. And via the primary prevention model, we talk again about stopping a health challenge before it really has a chance to nest and then get worse over time. And so for some people, experiencing economic stress can be completely debilitating. And I talk about several, and I include several stories of people who are experiencing economic stress in the book, who have never been exposed to it. So chances are, if they don't have an effective social support system, and if they do not have the capacity as individuals to manage how the economic stress may make them feel, that could be the recipe for the emergence or the exacerbation of a health challenge.
And as you've said earlier, people who have lived in poverty for much of their lifetimes are incredibly creative and resilient because they have to be. And yet somebody who has been sort of, you know, coasting along and has now emerged in a concern may not have the same internal resources to manage the stress.
Well, and that poor person may have become an expert along with their ingenuity and intellect to be able to navigate living hour to hour, day to day, versus the person who may have years of experience, advanced degrees, who has never been exposed to economic stress, who may have had a very, very successful career, had a comfortable lifestyle, who finds themselves very unceremoniously and very precipitously launched into unemployment and all the vet can encounter, can include, they don't have the mental wherewithal to cope with that. And it could be because of pride and ego. It may be because of guilt and shame. It may be because I have become accustomed to living a certain lifestyle, and now you want me to act as if I am a pauper. I can't do that. And so levels of resilience can vary widely from person to person based on their own experiences, based on their individual capacity, and also based on the mechanisms, again, of social support that they may have in their lives. And I especially talk about having effective social support for men, because for men who have lost their capacity through economic stress, job loss, what have you, to protect and provide for their families, it can be absolutely devastating. And not just that, Dr. Brewer, but it's also because men tend to internalize.
Right.
Because to convey any type of weakness would be an indictment of that man's manhood. And so what I'm here to say to your listeners is that talking to someone, a person with whom you trust, spouse, partner, a person from the faith community, it could be joining a social support group, is not conveying any type of weakness, but it really exalts your humanity. And so for far too many men, we tend to internalize and we act as if everything is okay when, in fact, life could be far from that.
It sounds, thank you for that, because I absolutely agree with you that men have unfortunately been taught to do rather than be and feel. And it is so important that the fullness of a human being be attended to. As we talk about economic stress, I mean, clearly it sounds like as a nation, perhaps it's time to rethink what we call economic success, how we define ourselves as being individually successful. Because as you said, so much of, at least some of the economic stress can come when your sense of the things that you have acquired, can acquire, will acquire, is disturbed, and you start to feel dreadful about yourself.
Well, we're being forced to redefine it.
Okay.
We're being forced to redefine what success and the American dream are in the 21st century because of things like job scarcity. We know that there's been outsourcing. We also know that the private sector has now become acclimated to having a much smaller pool of workers. And this is just the beginning, because some have even argued that there is a fourth industrial revolution on the horizon, which will largely displace human capital in favor of machines and technology. And so I think now is the time to really hit the reset button, particularly for those people who may have been displaced, and identify those niches, those niche areas where you may have a skill or a talent, and ask yourself if it may be possible to find a gap in the marketplace for that particular skill or talent, cultivate it, and then seek to monetize it. And what I'm saying, in effect, is that more and more people are being forced, Dr. Brewer, to become what I call 1099ers or independent consultants, because many of the concerns that typically had a pool of employees have jettisoned them to now become consultants. And so they may be hired in the capacity of short, fixed-term types of assignments for which they will be responsible for their taxes, their health insurance, their retirement, and what have you, in order to retain work with that company. And that is something that some people are embracing, but more people are terrified of, because they have been used to having their taxes and all those other things that have to go to the government and Social Security and Medicare taken care of for them. And so we're in an age now where we can no longer rely on a single source of income. And I am a huge advocate of creating multiple funding streams.
Multiple,
absolutely.
If
you are reliant on one source of income and that source goes away for whatever the reason, then the question is, and now what are you prepared to do? And so because of the cost of living continuously escalating, there are many people who are living quite modestly, but the cost is so high, i.e. the District of Columbia, that they're still in situations where, unfortunately, they're living paycheck to paycheck.
It's enough to leave someone with a whole bunch of bad dreams. Talk to us about Theodore.
Well, Theodore is a civil engineer by training, a mid-career professional, and one night he literally woke up swinging over his bed because he was dreaming that someone was choking the life out of him, and so he was defending himself. But as he calmed down and thought more about the dream, it was actually the manifestation of the economic stress in his life. And so this was a man who had done quite well up until a few years ago. He was the type of person who took the lavish vacations. He had a great wardrobe. He drove nice cars. He had a fabulous home. And he often went out with friends. He would always be the person, well, not always, but oftentimes he'd be the one that would pick up the tab. Just a really nice man. But over the last several years, he began to see some of his colleagues get laid off, and eventually he was one of the folks who was let go. And so he was able to hold on for a while, but after about a year or so, his savings, and thankfully he did have some, became depleted. And so now he's in a situation where he had become a recluse because being able to go out and go out to dinner and go to sporting events and the theater and all those things had to stop. One of the experiences he relayed to me that isn't in the book was the time that he went out with a group of friends, about 10 or 12 people. Originally, the idea was we're going to split the check evenly, 12 ways. After some imbibition on the part of some of the folk around the table, a few hours go by, someone says, well, let's just split the check down the middle. Well, that really messed up Theodore because he only had a certain amount of money in his pocket that he could allocate for dinner. And so what ended up happening was he had to very discreetly ask a friend if he could cover the part of the bill that he could not afford. And he was humiliated by it because this was a man who typically might pay for that whole table of 12. And now he's in a situation where he's got to ask someone for $25 or $30 to make up the amount that he was missing from the bill. So think about how that made him feel as a man and as an adult to be in his now 50s in a situation where he really can't go out anymore because if it comes to any uncertainty around money, that's going to create a problem.
And, you know, depending, as you said earlier, depending on his family experiences, depending on who he is as an individual, he could be ripe not only for depression, but for major depression, and really require services that he, if he's looking to meet with a professional, might not be able to afford.
Well, he experienced episodic depression because, as you sort of alluded to, he was the go-to person in his family. And you know that individual I'm talking about. Typically, there tends to be one or two people in everyone's family who's the money person. So all things financial have to go through that person because they're the person with the resources. Theodore was that person in his family. So if it was helping out a niece or a nephew or maybe a sibling, he was the person that would get the phone call. And for a time, for quite a while, he was the person who could always respond in the positive. So imagine, if you will, the levels of guilt and shame that he also experienced, which fueled the depression because he was no longer in a position to do those types of things for his family as a 50-some-year-old man.
You know, when you really think about it, it's stunning in the pervasiveness of the issue, and certainly the experience. And as you said, particularly for men, and I would say African American men have a particular challenge in this area, just because of what the world suggests and expects and demands of African American men in particular.
Well, it can be very. And for men in general, but I would dare say for black men in particular, we have an image to maintain. We want to be looked upon in positive ways despite the imagery of us that is not always positive. And so I was being very diplomatic just now.
Yes, you were. It was excellent.
Yeah, but it is particularly affecting, and I would like to share with you a worst case scenario. And this occurred last year in Baltimore, where a black man, a middle aged black man, who held a PhD in organizational development, came home one day. And let me just sort of preface this by saying he was a person who had been experiencing economic stress for several years. He was not able to find stable work. And so his last job was a part-time position from which he was laid off. He came home last July. He shot and killed both of his sons before he took his own life. Now, he had been experiencing depression, but based on the reports from the newspapers, it wasn't clear if there were more serious mental health issues, but I only cite that to corroborate the point that you just made about the depression can sometimes lead to things that are far worse. And so this is why I cannot stress enough the importance of talking with someone, because one of the worst things that can happen when you are experiencing the isolation and depression is to be left alone with your thoughts. That's when some very, very terrible things can enter your mind and then be manifested through behavior. And so having a mechanism of social support is key, and that needs to be done very seriously in terms of the selection of that individual, because you want someone that you can trust. You want someone with whom you can lay yourself bare. You want someone who's not going to be judgmental. You also want someone who's going to help raise your spirits, not increase your anxiety about whatever the issue is. And you also want that individual to be able to give you constructive feedback, because sometimes people will choose someone that they know is going to tell them what they want to hear as opposed to what they need to hear.
Well, that's very true, too. And the only thing that I would add to that is that it's also important to work with someone. And this is not a racial issue. It is important to work with someone who understands and can understand what this stress means to you as the individual. It may not be something that they've ever dealt with, or it may be something they deal with every day, but they need to understand where you are in this moment. And that goes back to what you just said in terms of the person being non-judgmental and skilled.
Right. You're absolutely right. So the cultural competence, but also the culture of humility, which means that the healthcare provider understands that he or she may not have all the answers, but they are in a constant state of learning. And this goes back to being a lifelong learner. And so this is also important in facilitating a productive and effective and useful interaction between that healthcare provider and the healthcare recipient.
Absolutely. You talk in your book about ways to actually secure that new position, ways to think about securing that new position, and you make the distinction between what you call simple networking and building relationships. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to start there, because I think that for many people, networking is the thing, and you don't have time to build a relationship, but you go, you network, you give somebody your card, and networking is done. You move on to the next person. So when we come back, I'd like to pick up with that.
Okay.
Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You are listening to Mind Talk, and we will return in just a moment. Dr. Brown, what's the difference between networking and building relationships? It seems like one would just take a whole bunch of time.
Yeah, well, Yeah, the relationship part does take time, but networking is really a one-way interaction. And what I mean by that is when you network, usually that's a situation where you see someone with whom you'd like to interact for a brief moment, you make a quick introduction, you tell a person who you are, you exchange business cards if that can happen, and you go on your way hoping that something fruitful will come from it. But chances are nothing will ever come from it because you didn't offer anything in the exchange. Versus building a relationship, same scenario where you may have an encounter with an individual, you may talk a little bit about what you do, but in that conversation, you're also expressing to the individual what it is you could assist them with getting accomplished. And so what that does is it changes the interaction from an asymmetric one to a more symmetric one. And so over time, building a relationship is far more likely to get you the traction in the job market that you seek. And I think part of the misinformation, particularly that is given to young people, high school graduates or college graduates, is that all you have to do is exchange a business card, and then you go on your way, and everything is going to work out. And chances are that's not going to happen. And that's why I illustrate in some detail in the book about the importance of building relationships via mentors or sponsors. And so with the mentor, obviously that's the person who helps to guide your professional development, but the sponsor is even more important because that person gives you access to the individual who makes hiring decisions because she or he will leverage some of their own political capital on your behalf. But the only way that happens is if you make the person who becomes a sponsor look good in some capacity. So that means that what is it that you can offer to that individual who might, over time, be willing to sponsor you?
All right, so now you're almost giving new meaning to the concept that when parents, for example, will say to the young college graduate, your job is to get a job. You're giving new meaning to that concept, and you're really broadening it out. If I've been out of work for X number of months or years, do I really feel like I have anything to offer? And do I really want to take the time to try to offer it? I want to get paid. I want to get paid right now.
Well, you could get paid right now perhaps by finding a job that will pay you a lower wage. But if you are interested in a career, a salary position with benefits and room for growth and advancement over time, then that is going to require an investment of a far longer term. And I think that going back to young people, for the listeners who may be in college or even in high school, the time to begin to build relationships is right now. One of the things that I've encountered with students from different institutions is that they focus on, well, now that I'm in my second semester of my last year, I guess I need to go look for a job or try to find something. And I'm saying to myself, you probably waited 2 or 3 years too long to do that. And so the process of looking for work at the college level really needs to begin that freshman year because, again, we're talking about building a relationship. And so as you build these relationships with different people, over time you will create a network.
It sounds like it would be useful for parents of the high school and the college age students to really talk to them about finding a way to generate some sort of income, to have a job, as you said, to start building those relationships then. There are so many parents who will say your job is to go to school and are absolutely opposed to that.
But I think a part of the challenge is that not all parents are having this type of conversation with their children. And so parents tend to give the best information they have at a particular point in time or that may have been passed down to them from their own parents. But what we know, particularly in the wake of the Great Recession, that job competition has skyrocketed. And part of the reason that it has skyrocketed is that because we have been turned into what I call virtual pieces of paper via the Internet. So when you send your resume or you fill out the application and you submit it electronically, you become just another piece of paper among all of the other pieces of paper. And this is why I say, and what that's done is it has removed the human element from the equation. That's why I say having an advocate, i.e. a sponsor, is invaluable. And so one of the other suggestions I often make is that the young person or the older person should have a profile on LinkedIn, which is a networking, a job networking site that allows job recruiters to see who you are. Job recruiters are using LinkedIn far more frequently now than ever. So if you have at least a profile on LinkedIn with parts of your resume, some of the things that you have accomplished, chances are you will be seen by a wider pool of people than if you simply sent your resume or application to the company's website.
That's interesting. So LinkedIn is a real tool to use when you're looking for employment that really works for you.
Absolutely. And LinkedIn is not Facebook. LinkedIn is not the place to post pictures of your vacation to the Bahamas or being out with friends. It is not that. It is for serious professionals. And so it's really important that the information that you're posting on your profile on LinkedIn reflects a level of seriousness and professionalism, because you never know who's watching, and the answer is someone is always watching. So you want to put your best face forward, in this instance literally, because it may be the mechanism through which you find employment that is actually commensurate with your training and skills.
Well, you brought up the word, so now I have to piggyback on it. You used the dreaded word Facebook. For those people, young and older, who use Facebook to say, do whatever, anything they choose, could that have a negative impact or no impact on their ability to look for work? Let's say they've got a great professional profile on LinkedIn, but they've got a lot of silliness on Facebook. Is that a problem? Do you get concerned about that?
It is absolutely a problem, and I've had several students come to me and say, well, Dr. Brown, I had this great job, and then all of a sudden they took the offer off the table. And I said, well, did you find out what happened? And they later learned that the recruiter or manager looked on Facebook and saw the shenanigans of this individual on Facebook as opposed to LinkedIn, and the shenanigans on Facebook trumped what was on LinkedIn. And so it is, and so this often gets missed by the 18, 19, 20-year-old, because Facebook, it's like no holds barred in many instances, but that can really come back to haunt you when it comes time to find work, because these social media mechanisms are being perused very often by job recruiters, because in addition to what you present on the pages of a resume, people also want to find out a little bit, as much as they can anyway, about who you are as a person. And this is because the capacity for human interaction in the job applicant process has been largely removed. And so people need to go on something, and so they tend to go on things like Facebook, and they see all of these pictures and people saying certain things and perhaps using the inappropriate language, and that can count against you in terms of being accepted and offered a position for work.
Does it make sense to shut down your Facebook page if you're looking for work?
No, it just makes sense to use good common sense.
Okay.
But as we know, common sense isn't common.
Well,
but
that's
it's
true.
Important to be careful not only about what you're posting, but what you allow others, i.e. friends of yours on Facebook, to post. Because the old adage, guilt by association, definitely applies.
Gotcha. Let's switch to just another piece that you talk about in more detail in your book, and that is, I've lost my job, or I'm about to lose my job, my bills are late, my mortgage is late, my rent is late, and people are calling me. What do I do?
Well, if you suspect that a layoff may be in your future, or you have already been laid off, the time to call bill collectors is today. Because the more proactive you can be with bill collectors, the more likely you are to get the help that you need. And an example of that would be, say, for example, you have a utility bill, maybe it's the electricity or the gas, and it has escalated. And so let's use the scenario of a person who feels that they may, in fact, be laid off. Well, now's the time to call that utility company and let them know that my capacity to meet my financial obligations may be compromised because of an impending layoff, and then ask if there is a payment plan. Doing that now does a couple of things. One, it demonstrates responsibility to the utility company about you. It also puts you in a position where you're more likely to get the help, as opposed to letting that bill just sit in the mailbox, or you now are in a situation where you get a late notice or even a cutoff notice. Because if you make the call once you've gotten a late notice, but especially a cutoff notice, chances are the utility company is going to require the entire balance due in order to retain use of the service. And so put yourself in a situation where you're more likely to be able to manage it over time, as opposed to being in a situation where you've got to come up with a utility payment that may be hundreds of dollars. And the same thing goes with things like a car payment. There are certain scenarios where if you talk to the loan officer, they will allow you to place maybe one, two, or three payments at the back of the loan. So say, for example, you're paying a car for 36 months. You make the call indicating that your capacity to meet that car note has been compromised because of a job layoff. Would it be possible for me to put two or three payments at the back of the loan? Now, what that will do is it will extend, obviously, the amount of money you end up paying ultimately, but what it also helps you to do is to manage your finances more effectively, and it keeps negative reporting from being sent to the credit bureaus, because credit is obviously very important. So those are just a couple of examples of how you can manage the economic stress more effectively. And another is also to take out what is called renter's insurance, which might pay you several hundred dollars that could help you meet some of the other financial obligations that you have.
What about calling, you mentioned the word credit, what about calling credit card companies and giving them the same information and seeing if there's a way to not only shift your payments around for a bit, but maybe to actually reduce or suspend the interest? Is that possible?
Well, yes, it is. I would certainly advocate asking the credit card company if they could not just suspend a payment, and sometimes they will allow you to miss a payment for 30 days, but also to reduce the interest rate, or maybe put you on a payment plan that may spread the payments over a longer period of time but allow you to pay a smaller amount until you get back on your feet. And the other thing, too, getting back on your feet to some people means that, well, I'm going to find a job in the next couple of months. And sometimes it may actually take years. And so you've got to look at this from the longer perspective. And so talking to the credit card company about the situation as early as you can, again, put you in a situation where they're more likely to help you. And if you have been paying on time, you've been a good customer with the particular credit card company, they're far more likely to work with you as opposed to saying, well, the payment is still going to be due. And on the topic of credit cards, it's really important if you're experiencing economic stress to have a cash and carry mindset. That means that when you walk into a store, you should own the item once you've left the store. Or if you don't own the item once you left the store, you should be in a position where you can pay that item off within the ensuing 30 days so that you're not creating more debt.
All right, so clearly you have just rocked the world in perhaps a challenging way for much of America.
Well, this is information, and I think one of the reasons that I wanted to write this book was to empower people with good information. Because one of the things that can happen when you experience economic stress is that you can just panic. It's like, I don't know what to do. I don't know where to start. I don't know how I'm going to get this done. And so what I'm saying is, and it lays it out in the book, there's a step-by-step approach that you can use as you are trying to manage the economic stress so things don't fall completely apart. But the tendency is when things fall apart, it's because you've done nothing. And one of the things, and a quick example of that, is what I call the not walking to the mailbox syndrome, where you know what's in the mailbox, but you don't want to walk to it because you know you can't afford to pay it. Well, that's not going to help make the situation better. It's actually going to make the situation worse. So go to the mailbox at least three times a week, even though it may not be an easy thing to do, because you don't want those bills to become late notices, and you certainly don't want the late notices to become shutoff notices.
Absolutely. Dr. Brown, you have given us so much to think about this hour. Is there a way for people to get more information about what you're doing or the book? Is there a website?
Sure. The website is economicstresshelp.com, economicstresshelp, H-E-L-P.com. The book is available on that website. It's in paperback and also Kindle versions, and you can certainly reach out to me via the website as well.
The idea that we've been talking about today, the ideas that we've been discussing, for a lot of people, there's a lot of anger that is connected with, let's say, the older worker who's worked for years and done everything that he or she knew to do, and now life is looking very differently. Or the youngster or the mid-range professional who's done all kinds of training and education, and now, you know, you're saying that what is likely to come is that there will be fewer and fewer jobs available. How do they deal with that anger and disappointment?
Well, the anger is warranted. Anger is warranted, starting with the older worker, baby boomers, if you will, born between 1946 and 1964. We didn't sign up for this because we were taught that if you go to school, you get a good education, you defer immediate gratification, you play by the rules, you too will have your chance at the American dream, and you should be able to prosper. That happened for some of us, but some of us have also gotten caught in this later debacle called the Great Recession. The problem is, you've got folk in their 40s, 50s, and 60s who have another 30 years to live who are trying to figure out, and now what am I going to do? That's scary, and that can produce a lot of anger. The other end of the spectrum, you've got the millennial generation, those 18 to 35, who have, again, followed the rules. They went and got the piece of paper, i.e. the college degree, and they now cannot leverage that degree into commensurate employment opportunities. And what makes it even more unforgivable for young people of color, black people in particular, is that so many of these young people have student loan debt, sometimes to the tune of over $100,000. And so if you're only working a job that pays you $8 an hour, you will never be able to pay off that debt. And so what it's done is it has compromised the capacity of this young generation to get an economic foothold and to build wealth in their own lives, which is compounded by the fact that many of their parents have been adversely affected by the economy, the economic downturn, and they are no longer able to what? Sponsor their children so that they can have a fresh start. So the anger is very warranted, but what I'm saying is, in spite of the situation, there are things that you can do today to manage the economic stress more effectively, and one of the things that I advocate at the end of the book is entrepreneurship. And again, it goes back to something we talked about at the top of the show about finding a niche in the marketplace where you have a great talent, something that you could offer to the world, and find a way to monetize it.
Dr. Robert Brown, author of Economic Stress, Harsh Truths and Keys to Empowerment, a medical sociologist. The website, one more time, Dr. Brown.
It's www.economicstresshelp.com. It's all one word.
Terrific. Thank you again so very much for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
All righty. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk, which is brought to you on a daily basis to provide you with information that you can use right now, today. Mind Talk is available to you on demand at myndtalk.org. Mind Talk is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional, and is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, the best place to go is the Mind Talk website. Again, that is myndtalk.org. And folks, remember, if it's unacceptable, that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.